There are a few seats up front, a few seats around the periphery, over there. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. On behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board, I want to welcome you to this program to examine the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act as it affects Medicare. I also want to commend you for being willing to spend an hour and a half inside on a day like today instead of holding this session over in the park the way we should have done. Now, in the last couple of weeks, we've looked at sessions like this at Medicaid and private insurance. And as a footnote, we're going to do a session on Monday on payment policy in the new law. But the changes to Medicare that we're going to be talking about today were among the most hotly debated of any of the issues in a supremely contentious piece of legislation. And those changes in the end were fairly wide-ranging. Some improvements in benefits, some restrictions on different areas of spending, increases in Medicare payroll taxes for some incentives to improve quality, maybe most interestingly, some initiatives in changing the way care is delivered that have the potential to reshape the broader healthcare system in a positive way. And today's program is going to help us learn more about exactly how that reform law is likely to change Medicare and vice versa, as a matter of fact. We hope to give everybody a relatively objective view of what's in there, as we're calling this series. And we're pleased to have as the partner in today's program, as we have for the last couple of Fridays, the Kaiser Family Foundation, which, as a matter of fact, has just published a new, very user-friendly guide to the Medicare changes in the reform law that's in your packets. And I'm very pleased also to have as co-moderator, again, the executive director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and the executive vice president of the foundation, Diane Rowland. Diane?
Oh, thank you, Ed. And I'll share with Ed the sentiment that we're glad that you would come to a briefing instead of opting to be outside on this beautiful day. But I think it just points to the importance of understanding the many major changes that the health reform legislation has made in both the Medicaid program and private insurance. And less noted to some, but important to all who look at and care or are covered by Medicare, the Medicare program. So today, I'm pleased to be joined by Tricia Newman from the Kaiser Family Foundation, Tom Alt and Jonathan Blum, to really lay out for you some of the dynamics of the changes in the health reform legislation that affect Medicare. This, like our other briefings, is intended to be a 101, not to be an exhaustive examination of any particular issue in the law, so that I hope you will hold your questions and ask even the most basic questions if you have them and not feel you have to be engaged in a very detailed discussion on some smaller aspect of the program. So without further ado, I'll turn it back over to Ed so we can start the briefing and then get to your questions.
Thanks, Diane. I just wanted to mention that the materials in your packets are supplemented by a series of materials that are available online at allhealth.org. You do have biographical information about our speakers, so we won't be doing justice to the introductions that they should get. There'll be a webcast of this briefing available on Monday at kff.org, a service of the Kaiser Family Foundation. There'll be a transcript available at the Alliance website, allhealth.org, in a few days after that. There's a blue evaluation form we hope you fill out before you leave. There's a green question card you can use at the appropriate time during the Q&A session. And that is all I need to say, other than that, as Diane noted, we have terrific speakers who know a lot and can answer both the most basic and the most sophisticated questions. So anywhere along that range, you should feel free to try to get what you need. We're going to start with Tricia Newman, who is a vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation and directs the Medicare Policy Project there. She spent 6 years on the professional staff of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Health, and 3 years on this side on the staff of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, dealing with health and long-term care issues. She's been on Alliance programs for years, and we're very pleased to have you with us.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Diane. And it's great to see everybody here, and I know there's a lot of expertise in the room, so I'm happy to see you all here. Before I get going, I just want to acknowledge the Medicare Brain Trust that from the Kaiser Family Foundation that has come with me today, Juliet Kubanski, Gretchen Jacobson, and Jennifer Huang, all of whom have contributed to the materials that you have. Getting to Medicare, I think it's fair to say when the debate all began, Medicare really was not a big... Medicare was not a major issue in the health reform discussions, but over time, as you know, Medicare did evolve to become a key issue. Medicare, just for those of you who want to be sure you're in the right room, is the program for elderly and disabled Americans. Medicare was part of these discussions in part because it's a big part of the budget, 12% of the federal budget. Medicare became a part of discussions, particularly about controlling costs, because Medicare is a major payer and player in the healthcare system at 23% of national healthcare spending. So Medicare became a pretty big deal, as I think you all probably realized. We don't have time to go into all the details about all the provisions, and I'm just going to cover some of what you might think of as the new and noteworthy provisions in a few areas: benefit improvements, Medicare Advantage. I'm going to talk about the new Independent Payment Advisory Board and some of the revenue provisions that are in the legislation. And then Tom's going to talk about provider payments and delivery system issues. And John is going to tell us how all this is going to be implemented. So let's start with what people might call the sweetest part of health reform for people on Medicare: the donut hole. Come on. The donut hole. As you know, it was an unusual feature in the Medicare drug benefit that was implemented in 2006. It has been an issue for seniors. It has resulted in people not filling prescriptions, high out-of-pocket costs. We estimated that 3.5 million people had spending in the coverage gap. So one of the major improvements to Medicare that was included in the health reform legislation was improved coverage for people, gradually phased in over time if they have spending in the donut hole. So 2010, there's a $250 rebate that will go to people who have any spending in the coverage gap. Beginning in 2011, a 50% discount on brand-name drugs provided by pharmaceutical companies will be implemented and will stay permanently. Also beginning in 2011, Medicare coverage for generic drugs will be phased in. Beginning in 2013, Medicare coverage for brand-name drugs will be phased in. So by 2020, Medicare beneficiaries who have spending high enough to reach what would have been the coverage gap will be spending 25% as they have all along if they were in the standard benefit package. For those of you who like pictures better than a lot of words, let me show you what this means in a visual sense. When you look at the slide over there, we have a before and we have an after, and this is if fully implemented. When you see the yellow, think beneficiary payments. When you see blue, think payments that beneficiaries don't incur. So on the left side, you have what Medicare beneficiaries would have spent under a standard Part D plan if they had spending high enough to reach the coverage gap. And as you can see, the yellow greatly diminishes when you move from left to right on that slide. Moving along very quickly, because we are just skimming the surface, I want to talk a little bit about the broad savings that are in the legislation. As you all know, the Medicare provisions slowed the growth in Medicare spending, and there are a number of savings provisions, most of which Tom's going to talk about. I want to focus just briefly on the Medicare Advantage savings provisions, which, as you see, account for about a quarter of the total savings. About 1 in 4 people on Medicare are now in a Medicare Advantage plan. Congress focused on Medicare Advantage payments because there was significant amount of research put forward by independent analysts, including MedPAC, outside experts, CBO, the actuary.
I'm trying to get you from.
Sorry. Sorry. That pointed out high payments to Medicare Advantage plans relative to traditional Medicare. So Medicare Advantage plan, so Medicare pays more for people who are in Medicare Advantage plans than it would pay for similar people in traditional Medicare. Congress heard the evidence in the health reform legislation. They modified payments to Medicare, and I'm not going to go into the details about how they do that, but they modify payments to Medicare to bring payments closer to fee-for-service traditional Medicare spending in the county. They also make other changes that have the effect of reducing payments. As sort of a countervailing set of provisions, Congress for the first time provides additional payments to plans based on their quality ratings. And if any of you have gone to the Medicare website, looked at Medicare Advantage plans, you can see that there are stars, star ratings for plans, and that is now being used as a way to reward plans for getting high quality ratings. The legislation also includes some consumer protections, limits on cost-sharing requirements, and for the first time establishes loss ratio requirements that will be enforced by the Secretary. Moving along again very quickly, I want to spend a little bit of time on the new Independent Payment Advisory Board that is also set up in the legislation to achieve savings. This is a fundamentally different way of approaching Medicare payment policy that has been enacted in the legislation. There is a new board with 15 full-time members appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate, who will serve six-year terms. The first set of recommendations that they issue will be due in 2014 to take effect in 2015. The board receives information from the Office of the Actuary that tells them about Medicare spending. And if Medicare spending exceeds certain growth rates, as defined in the statute, the board is required to submit proposals to achieve specified savings. And again, the savings levels are defined in the statute. Congress has a limited amount of time to review these provisions, but if Congress does not enact alternative proposals that achieve the same level of savings, the Secretary is required to implement the savings automatically. So that really is a very different way of doing business, and it is intended to slow the growth in Medicare spending and keep Congress's feet to the fire. There are some restrictions. The board cannot ration care, reduce benefits, increase cost sharing, modify benefits, eligibility or premiums, or raise taxes. And before 2020, there are restrictions on what the board can do for certain providers, primarily inpatient hospitals. I want to touch very briefly on some revenue provisions that are included. There is a new income-related Part B premium provision. It takes under current law, there is a provision that requires high-income Part B enrollees to pay a higher premium. Beneficiaries with incomes above a certain income threshold pay a higher premium. Under current law, that income threshold rises over time so that a constant share of beneficiaries will pay the premium. That current law is no longer current law. With the new legislation, a growing share of people will be subject to the higher income Part B premium. There is now a similar provision applied to individuals enrolled in Part D plans. So they, too, will be paying a higher Part D premium. There is also the payroll tax provision that got a great bit of attention. So individuals with incomes over $200,000, earnings over $200,000, and couples over $250,000 will see an increase in their payroll tax from 1.45% to 2.35%. And there are some changes in the tax treatment of the retiree drug subsidy under the Part D program, all of which brings revenue into the program. There are also some fees, which I'm sure you've heard about, but they are not really specifically Medicare fees, although the fees on the pharmaceutical industry do get deposited into the Supplemental Medical Insurance Fund. Taken together, which you can see here, is when you add benefits, which increases spending, and you and you look at the savings provisions, the legislation still significantly slows the growth in Medicare spending and reduces spending over time. Just looking at 2019, you could see that the Medicare baseline it drops by about $100 billion as a result of the legislation. Another effect of this, the spending reductions in the new revenue provisions, is that it increases the life of the Part A trust fund. It extends its solvency from 2017 to 2029, according to projections of the actuary. So there's lots here. There's lots to follow. I think that's going to be my brief overview. If you want more detailed information, we have more on our website at kff.org.
Terrific. Thanks, Tricia. Now we turn to Tom Ault, who's a partner with Health Policy Alternatives, one of the most respected health policy analyst firms in town. Tom's been at HPA since 1997. Before that, he spent almost a decade in senior positions in what is now the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, almost another decade in the Office of the Secretary working on Social Security and welfare issues. So they say he knows this stuff. Tom, would you share some of that wisdom with us?
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here and to have such great attendance on such a beautiful day. Thank you all for honoring us with your presence. One of the twin goals of the health reform legislation, besides coverage and insurance reform, was so-called delivery system reform, bending the cost curve, getting cost growth in healthcare under control. There were actually a couple of delivery system reforms that were enacted before the healthcare reform law in the fiscal stimulus package that passed in February of 2009. That provided $1.1 billion in comparative effectiveness. I'm on about the fourth slide now. Is that?
There's a reason.
I have to be doing it.
Yes, on the right end. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. The fiscal stimulus package included $1.1 billion in comparative effectiveness research and $19 billion in health information technology funding. The healthcare reform law came later and provided more of a structure for the comparative effectiveness research. And these additional payments for health information technology are not at all insignificant. Over the next decade, $14 to $27 billion will be available to eligible professionals, physicians and other practitioners, and to eligible hospitals who become meaningful users of health information technology. The legislation included many changes in Medicare, hopefully to bring some delivery system reform. Notion is that's a focus on Medicare, which is a major program in its own right, and if these are successful there, that's a good thing. And if they get adopted by others, that's even a better thing. So higher payment for primary care physicians and payments to medical homes were included. There's a voluntary pilot program beginning in 2013 for bundling services before and after, as well as during a hospital stay. And this could include physician services, emergency room services prior to the admission, and post-acute care services, including nursing homes, home health agencies, rehabilitation facilities, and so on. It's a voluntary program. It can be extended if it's found to be successful by the secretary and certified to save by the actuary. There's also a provision called Medicare Shared Savings Program, which are these accountable care organizations. This begins in 2012. An accountable care organization is a group of providers, primarily multi-specialty physician practices and hospitals who work together to provide more efficient care and higher quality care. And again, this is a voluntary program. It's modeled after a demonstration program that's ongoing today in its fifth year, the Physician Group Practice Demonstration. Accountable care organizations that are successful in achieving savings will receive incentive payments that come from a portion of those savings. They also have to meet quality standards. The legislation will lower payment for preventable hospital readmissions. There's been a lot written over the last few years about high readmission rates following a hospital discharge. And this legislation begins with three conditions, heart attack, heart failure, and pneumonia, and expands to additional conditions, and would reduce payments to hospitals if they have high readmission rates in these areas. This begins in 2013. The reduction that would be applicable to a hospital in that year cannot exceed 1%, and then 2% and 3% in 2014 and 15, respectively, and 3% after that. There's also a payment reduction for healthcare acquired conditions. So if a patient acquires an infection or some other condition during their hospital stay, that's considered a hospital acquired or healthcare acquired condition. And there will be reductions of 1% for the hospitals that have the highest rates of acquired conditions. And that begins in 2015. And then there's many provisions dealing with value-based purchasing. We've had a number of programs that have provided incentives to physicians or required hospitals as a condition to getting their full annual update to report quality measures. This legislation now moves to actually basing a portion of the payment on performance on quality measures for hospitals and physicians, and to be expanded to other providers over time. There are provisions to address geographic variation, both variation caused by the adjustments that Medicare makes for geographic differences in wages and the like, and also variation due to practice patterns, high utilization areas of the country. And finally, there's a Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center that will begin in 2012, and I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Just wanted to show how much of a hospital's payments by 2017 are going to be dependent partially on how they do in various quality areas. So by 2017, 6% of hospitals' base DRG payments are potentially at risk depending on their quality performance. 1% for hospital-acquired conditions by 2017, 3% for the readmissions, and 2% for the value-based purchasing program. So clearly, this is a change in the way Medicare has paid, and one would expect some provider response. There's also I didn't even intend to be funny. And when I do, I always fail. Also, quality reporting for physicians. The optional physician quality incentive program today provides a 1% bonus, and that's going to be reduced. This program is going to be made permanent, and it's going to pay bonuses of 1%, declining to 5% over the period between now and 2014, half of a percent, I mean. And then beginning in 2015, there will be a 1.5 percentage point penalty, which for physicians who don't report quality measures, and that increases to a 2% penalty in 2016. So by 2016, physicians will be on the same footing as hospitals, which today they must report quality measures or they lose 2%, and that will also be true for physicians beginning in 2016. Secretary is required to integrate clinical reporting with electronic health records to make reporting of quality measures easier, and that's both for physicians and hospitals. There'll be a physician compare website. Now One can go to the CMS website and go to the Hospital Compare website and get comparative information on hospital performance. And the legislation requires that to be available for physicians as well. There's a new physician feedback program that will give physician information on their spending on a per beneficiary basis compared to other physicians treating patients with similar conditions. And then finally, there's value-based purchasing for physicians beginning in 2016, inapplicable to 1% of their payments. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation is designed to test innovative payment and service delivery models. This is sort of like the CMS Medicare demonstration program on steroids. So I think it's envisioned that there'll be many more projects funded and sometimes in very local areas, building on a private sector delivery system reform that's working in a particular area. Through this innovation center, Medicare could piggyback on that. The statute, the health reform law, includes a menu of 20 possible such models that could be tested, but really the sky's the limit, at least until we see regulations from the Secretary that may narrow it in some way. There's $10 billion available over a 10-year period for this. Just some observations on these delivery system reforms. While they're a key element of the health reform legislation, and there's a lot of hope resting on these, you must say they focus generally on setting up long-term shifts rather than achieving short-term budget savings. There's very cautious CBO scoring with most of these due to a lack of experience, but there clearly is hope that over time these will make major changes. Looking at some of the other changes in Medicare, there are update reductions that for hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, home health agencies, hospice programs, laboratory services, and dialysis facilities. And the legislation states specifically something that one hasn't seen before, which is that these reductions can cause a negative update. There's also a productivity offset that will require all providers in Medicare to become more efficient over time at the same rate, essentially, that productivity gains occur in the general economy. And these reductions begin in 2012. There's reductions in Medicare hospital disproportionate share adjustment. The disproportionate share adjustment is designed to offset the cost of treating uninsured patients. And with the greatly lowering rate of uninsurance in the country as a result of this legislation, this disproportionate share adjustment will gradually be phased back. There will be a residual payment that will be made, but it will be distributed to hospitals based on the amount of uncompensated care that they provide. And the last bullet on this slide doesn't really belong on this slide. It's supposed to have been on a slide two slides later, but since it's here, I'll talk about it. I put it in the wrong place. Nobody else did. New standards for the tax exemption of for nonprofit hospitals. So they will have to make reports to IRS in terms of what care they actually provide to the uninsured in order to maintain their nonprofit status. This slide summarizes the implementation dates, and you can see that in 2010, a number of the provider update reductions go into effect. 2011, there's a national quality strategy. Hospitals have to make their charges public, and the Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center begins. 2012, the productivity offset and the accountable care organizations. 2013, the preventable readmissions, the pilot project for bundling, value-based purchasing, and looking at misvalued physician codes. And then in 2014, the reductions for disproportionate share, additional quality reporting, and so on. So there's a real acceleration as one goes through time with these. Some other provisions, just to tick these off, and then we can address these in questions. Tricia talked about the Payment Advisory Board. I've already mentioned the comparative effectiveness research. There's some demonstration grants for alternatives to malpractice litigation. There's some changes in how on allowing approval of biological products, generic biological products, and changes on physician ownership and referral, physician ownership and investment transparency, and enhanced program integrity rules. So, closing, implications of the delivery system reform and these Medicaid changes, physician updates are going to continue to be year to year at this point because the legislation did not include anything on physician updates. So the sustainable growth rate, or SGR, issue with the Medicare physician fee schedule that's causing a reduction to 21%, that has not been addressed. And the prospect, at least at this point, is that this could be continue to be a year-to-year proposition. Also, there's a prospect of low or even negative inpatient hospital updates for at least the next 4 or 5 years due to not just changes in this law, but changes that were already in existing law and documentation and coding. Quality of care is clearly going to affect payments and public perception across the board, and that's a great message to be sending. There's going to be a significant increase in regulations to implement all these Medicare changes and these delivery system reforms, and there's the legislation provides broad administrative discretion for the development of these regs. With regard to the many pilot projects and demonstrations and so on, we don't know what participation will be or how effective these will be, but clearly there's a hope that we are on the cusp of some major delivery system changes and reform. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Tom. And I should note, we are going to discuss many of these payment changes and their implications at a session on Monday that many of you are signed up for. Our final speaker today is Jonathan Blum. Jonathan serves as the Deputy Administrator of CMS, and he directs the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service. I'm sorry, the Center for Medicare. He's effectively responsible for the health care of about 45 million elderly and disabled Americans, with an annual budget of hundreds of billions of dollars that grows to even more hundreds of billions over the period between now and 2019, as Tricia's chart showed us. He's been a Medicare advisor to the Senate Finance Committee members and its chairman, Max Baucus. He's told them about prescription drugs and Medicare Advantage policies. He's been a Medicare analyst at the White House Office of Management and Budget. I would say that for purposes of our discussion of Medicare reform implementation, we can simply call him the horse's mouth. Tom, thank you, or Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Ed, and thanks, Diane, for having CMS have the opportunity to talk a little bit about how we're thinking about implementing this awesome responsibility that's contained in the Affordable Care Act. And I think from my perspective, and I know for the 4,500 or so folks that work at CMS, this is a very daunting task, one that we're very humbled by, but one that we're also very excited by to take on this challenge. I agree with the points made by Tricia and by Tom that the Affordable Care Act really transforms the Medicare program. And the way that I think about it is it really has three kind of overarching goals. One is to think about changing how we pay providers, pay plans, to focus on value rather than simply just the volume of services, to change the payment systems to elevate the overall performance of the delivery of care through all the settings that is covered by Medicare, and to change the focus on the program that I know Secretary Sebelius has talked a lot about, is to focus on prevention and wellness rather than just paying for care. I think the Secretary has called the Medicare program and has been a program that pays for sickness. We want to make sure this is a program that pays for wellness. And I think that the principles and the policies that are in the Affordable Care Act really focus on value, focus on performance, and focus on wellness, focus on prevention. In order to prepare for these comments today, I had a chance to read the wonderful CRS summary on the provisions in the law just to get ready for this. And it's really difficult to kind of put everything into context because there is so much in this bill that changes the Medicare bill. I commend Tricia and commend Tom for putting this into a very succinct presentation. But the way that I think about the changes are in four categories. One is the more mechanical changes that the law has for the traditional fee-for-service payment systems, changing market baskets, changing update factors, more traditional mechanical changes that have very important implications, but from a CMS perspective, they're pretty much mechanical. Secondly is the changes in the law, both on the fee-for-service side but also on the private plan side, that will transform how care is delivered, the delivery of care. Thirdly is to think about the changes to the Part C program, the Medicare Advantage program, and also the changes to Part D. And the law requires a 10-year phase-out of the so-called donut hole. So I want to talk about each of those four, those four categories. Starting with the more mechanical changes, you will soon see CMS very soon start to implement the changes that take effect for 2011 through our traditional rulemaking cycles. We put out a couple weeks ago our proposed rule for the inpatient payment system for 2011. That proposal did not contain any of the provisions that affect the payment system that are included to the Affordable Care Act. We are going to soon propose phase two to the inpatient proposal for 2011 that will have many of the changes that affect the inpatient payment system. There are provisions that affect the market basket update. There are changes. There are changes that affect certain kinds of hospitals, low volume hospitals, frontier hospitals, and CMS very soon will propose phase two that will sync up to a final regulation under our traditional rate cycle. CMS, as always, will propose the physician payment update for 2011, and that will be the vehicle that will implement the cost-sharing changes for covered preventive benefits and also the new annual wellness visit. So you'll start to see our thinking and proposal through that traditional cycle. But because CMS has these vehicles that just are in place, inpatient rule, physician rule, skilled nursing, home health, those will be the vehicles that CMS tries to use to implement all of the changes. Some things take effect 2010, and you'll see changes through our program instructions, 2011 through our rate cycle. But over time, CMS will continue to use those existing vehicles to implement all the changes, both the mechanical, quote-unquote, changes, but also the more transformational delivery reforms that affect the fee-for-service program. The second category of changes I want to talk about are the delivery reforms that affect the fee-for-service program. Both Tom and Tricia talked about those changes. And I just want to make a couple of observations. One is I think we have an incredible opportunity to learn, to test, to pilot new ideas through the new Center for Innovation, but also the new Office for Dual-Eligible Coordination. I think there's some tremendous opportunities the agency has to improve the delivery of care, the overall quality of care for high-cost beneficiaries, those with chronic conditions, dual-eligible. My colleague, Tony Rogers, will be the point person at CMS to lead these new centers. But we understand there's tremendous interest and there is tremendous things going on within the healthcare delivery system today that we want to build upon. We don't necessarily want to reinvent, but we know there's great things happening at the local level, the plan level, the provider level, the state level, and it's our goal to kind of build upon these ideas, these initiatives, these reforms that are going on right now. Secondly, I think while there's a lot of focus right now on pilots and demonstrations, I think it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the delivery reforms that are in the Affordable Care Act are permanent policy, and Tom talked about these. But I think we have the Congress and the law has put in place permanent changes to how the Medicare program pays for fee-for-service benefits. For example, we talked about the accountable care organizations. That is not a pilot. That is national policy with the opportunity to pilot different models. CMS later this fall put out proposed rules to define what an accountable care organization is for national policy. National policy also includes that CMS will have to provide every physician a individualized confidential resource report that will soon over time transform to developing value-based payment modifiers to reward physicians for high value, higher quality services, more efficient services. Tom talked about the focus on value-based purchasing for hospital services, the programs to reduce unnecessary hospital readmissions, and also think about the efforts to focus more on bundled payments, post-acute hospital physician. The law also gives CMS the authority and the direction to look at every misvalued code that we have within the physician payment system. And I think one of the opportunities that we have to think about bundled services is through that process to look at misvalued codes to see if we can pay for care more efficiently. The third area is the changes to the MA program. And I know there's a lot of interest and a lot of concern regarding the payment changes that Congress made the Affordable Care Act to the MA program. I'm happy to take any questions and to engage in a discussion on this. But I believe very strongly that the Affordable Care Act helps to push the MA program back to its roots. And when I was on the Hill back in 2003, the argument was that the MA program would better coordinate care, would better improve patient quality, would focus on ways to improve the delivery of care. And I think since 2003 to today, that promise hasn't been met. A lot of the expansion to the MA program has happened in private fee-for-service plans that by definition cannot coordinate care, cannot help promote value. And I think given that Congress has now built in quality as a basis for payments, that will cause plans over time to have to compete based upon quality. It will have to have more conscious value-based programs for beneficiaries to ensure they have high-quality scores. So to me, when we think about delivery reform, when we think about trying to improve the quality of care, we always have to think about the MA program as one of our best vehicles to do that. And I think what's most exciting about the changes that Congress has made is the focus on value, the focus on quality, and to encourage plans to compete based on value, based on quality, and not necessarily on open network and other factors. CMS understands that given that the five-star quality system will be used for payment purposes for the first time, we have a responsibility to take a fresh look at the system. To date, it's used primarily to help beneficiaries understand plan options. But now that we're building it into payment policy, that's going to cause us to take a fresh look at how we produce, can assess plans. And you'll hear more guidance from CMS later this summer. But we also believe this is a system that will change over time. So Congress has said by 2012 we have to start incorporating this system, but it also gives the flexibility to the Secretary to help define what it means to be a five-star, four-star quality plan. So I fully expect that over time this will change, this will modify, to always have the goal to constantly promote quality improvement, value improvement for the MA program. The fourth area is the Part D changes. I'm happy to answer any questions about Part D. My time, I think, is running short. We are working very hard and very fast to ensure that the $250 checks are starting to be sent out on June 15th. CMS will continue to send checks throughout the year for those beneficiaries that hit the donut hole. We have put out guidance. We will soon publish model manufacturer rebate agreements for brand name drug manufacturers to enter into agreements with CMS.
John, I would just say if you need another minute or two, take it.
All right, good. One more minute. So the last thing that I'll say is two more points about sort of concluding observations. One is that CMS understands that these new programs, new initiatives, new delivery reforms is somewhat new to the agency. And so we're going to need lots of advice and lots of input and lots of feedback. And I have asked our staff to think about ways that we can channel the interest that is out there to help CMS build these changes. The ESRD payment changes that CMS proposed is a good example. We held a town hall meeting in CMS Baltimore headquarters where we had every stakeholder come to present, to offer advice, to offer criticism, to offer comments, and we really want to make sure that we are working as openly, transparently with all stakeholders to ensure that we can bring that feedback, bring that advice to CMS, because a lot of this is new. There's fantastic expertise that was started during the Bush administration and throughout. We're going to build upon that expertise, but again, we're going to work as transparently as possible to ensure that we're getting the best input, feedback, and comments. And the last point, I think that Tricia made this point, is that when we're changing benefits so dramatically and very excitingly, but at the same time, we need to make sure that these changes don't have unintended consequences for our beneficiaries. The agency will be doing everything possible to make sure that we are tracking in real time the impacts to beneficiaries and the changes in service delivery. And some of those changes may be very much appropriated and very much intended by the legislation. Some of those changes may not, potentially. We have a responsibility, we have an obligation to make sure that we're informing the Congress, informing the public of those impacts, of those changes. I believe, and Secretary Sebelius believes, that we need to be much more open at CMS about trying to assess these changes, track data, use claims information in real time. Some of you know that CMS made some very controversial changes to cardiology reimbursements last year. I'm sure the Hill staff heard about it. But we are tracking in real time the impacts on cardiology services week by week. And so I see a report once a week to assess how has cardiology services changed. And I'm pleased to say that we're not seeing any impacts. But at the same time, that's an example how I think the agency will have to be working in the future to set up those data tracking systems to make sure that we're telling the Congress, we're telling the public the impacts, both intended and unintended. And I think that's how you're going to see the agency working over the next several years. I'm sorry to exceed my time, and I will yield to Ed.
That's terrific. No, thank you very much, John. Now you get a chance to ask questions. Okay, there's a microphone, and there's a microphone. You can also fill out a green card, as some of you have already started to do. Hold it up, and someone will snatch it from your fingers and bring it forward. While you're doing that, let me start with one that's on a green card that quotes unnamed politicians as saying that no one will lose any guaranteed benefits, with guaranteed in quotes. But 10 million beneficiaries in Medicare Advantage get other benefits paid for by the extra payments that plans get now, which are, as we have heard, ending. They will lose benefits, won't they? Vision, hearing, podiatry, bigger bonuses in the donut hole for prescription drugs. Tricia, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, this is a question that a lot of people have asked, and I'm sure you've heard, for those of you working in congressional offices, from seniors about this issue. The truth is we really don't know exactly what's going to happen. The plans right now are in the process of deciding what they're going to be doing for 2011. And the payment changes that that will be implemented are phased in over a period of time. And so whatever happens is unlikely to happen dramatically and quickly. That said, there is the real possibility that plans will make some changes. And different plans may make different changes. And I think they're going to see how they think they can compete, or if they want to compete, in the environment and with the new payment system as it evolves. They are required under all circumstances to provide Medicare-covered benefits. So there's not a shot they're going to go out and market and not provide defined Medicare benefits. They may choose to cut back on benefits that are considered extra, like a contribution toward eyeglasses or contribution toward hearing aids. But we'll have to see. One thing that has been sort of lost in the discussions is about the additional benefits that people in Medicare Advantage will get under the legislation, because many Medicare Advantage plans don't have coverage in the donut hole. So, for example, in that particular case, people who are in Medicare Advantage plans could well see an improvement in their coverage as a result of improvements in coverage in the fee-for-service side. And there's also a provision that limits really high charges, cost-sharing requirements for certain services that have been allowed up until the legislation passed. So, you know, the concern is a real one. I think there will be changes. My own guess is it may not be dramatic, but we have to see. And people who stay in Medicare Advantage will be assured their Medicare benefits.
Okay. Yes, and I should say I'd ask you as you come to the microphone to identify yourself, keep the question as short as and clear as you can so that we can get through as many as we possibly can, and there are tons of questions. Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joanne Lynn. I'm really impressed with the array of things we've put into this package, and so I know we're feeling a bit overwhelmed. But it seems that there are two issues that are pervasive and effectively cut across a lot that could be capitalized on in the next few years and really move us ahead. One is the opportunity to make sense of the meaning of value in a population who are dying. So I know, you know, the death panel's got us all scared, but all of our metrics for quality really presume a commercial population for whom death is somewhere off in the future. In the Medicare population, we're all dying. So it seems that we have to start developing some metrics that make sense of what high-value care is in the context of a population who face dying. And our economic metrics and so forth just haven't dealt with that. So we have metrics on mammograms, but not on pain near death. And I'll bet there aren't very many 85-year-olds who would value the first and not the second. And the other is the opportunity for regional-based reforms. We have a toe in the water with accountable care organizations and maybe a little with bundling, but it seems that we've either focused upon individual providers or federal policy, and those intermediary institutions in communities are dramatically underdeveloped in the U.S., and it seems that some of the innovation might be to try to enable Dubuque to do better, to enable Peoria to take hold of its own care system and develop some authorities.
John?
I can take the question. I very much agree that we need to take a look at the different measures that CMS uses to assess quality, and not just CMS, but the entire healthcare system. The law requires the secretary working in consultation with outside stakeholders to develop quality measures. I'm not an expert in this area, but it's my observation that a lot of our quality measures we currently use in our payment systems, both at CMS and in the commercial world, tend to focus on, did you get a particular service? Did you get a test? Or you know, focus on the delivery of healthcare services. But I think the challenge is that Congress, the Affordable Care Act, really wants the healthcare system to be more efficient. And we don't have great measures for efficiency. I think that's going to be one of the hardest things that the CMS and ARC and, you know, all stakeholders have to address is how do we develop these measures for efficiency and value. And I think that's going to be one of our top challenges.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hi. My name is Stephen Spitz, and in 21 months I will be eligible for Medicare. So I have the following question. In the Kaiser Family Foundation brochure Focus on Health Reform, it states that beginning in 2011, enrollees with spending and coverage gap will receive a 50% discount on brand name drugs provided by the pharmaceutical industry. My question is that given the price-fixing scheme that was built into the Medicare Part D, barring the government from negotiating prices for drugs under Medicare, and given also the ban on reimportation of U.S. drugs from Canada, has continued. What in this legislation prevents the prices from, by that time, doubling so that the 50% discount would be meaningless?
I think it's a great question. I think it's a great concern. The legislation, as you know, we talked about, provides a offers a voluntary agreement with brand name manufacturers to offer a 50% discount. But there is a hook to that, in that any manufacturer that doesn't offer that discount, it is no longer considered a Part D covered drug. So there is a very strong incentive for manufacturers to participate. But I think, too, is that in setting the 50% threshold, there is still a recognition that that will provide incentives for beneficiaries to use generics and always have that to be sort of a cost-conscious proposition. So when Part D was set back in 2003, the goal really is to encourage Part D plans, to encourage beneficiaries to use the lowest-cost drug. While there is more opportunity to get discounts in the donut hole, at the same time, that dynamic, to me, won't be taken away. Your concern is valid about that, you know, this may cause brand name manufacturers to increase the prices of their drugs. And I think it's incumbent upon all stakeholders and CMS and others to, you know, kind of make sure people understand the relative prices of drugs. We post that information to our website to make sure that beneficiaries can see ways to reduce the overall cost of their drugs. But I think that will be incumbent to all of us to make sure those prices are as transparent as possible.
Tricia, you want to add something?
Well, I was just going to add, and maybe as an encouragement to John, this is a great area for more sunshine so that not only each individual Medicare beneficiaries, but all of us can watch what's going on with drug prices when this provision takes effect. I think this would be a really great area for more oversight and documentation.
And I think one of the things that we put in some of our guidance documents regarding this provision is that we really want to track the changes in drug utilization. We want to track these dynamics. And I think we'll be looking at this very carefully to provide the best recommendations to the Congress going forward.
Yes, right ahead.
Hi, Vicki Gottlich, Center for Medicare Advocacy. John, I was really pleased to hear that CMS is tracking changes for their real-time effect. And I was wondering if you and Tricia and Tom could talk about the Independent Payment Advisory Board and the potential impacts. There are many of us in the community who are really concerned that this is going to result in reductions in access despite all the beneficiary protections in the language. Thanks.
First, I think to be honest, Vicki, it's a little bit premature to speculate how the independent board will deliberate. The 15 members have yet to be appointed. This commission, I believe, doesn't start till 2012 or 2013 with the first recommendations starting in 2014. But I think when Congress did set up the parameters to the commission, they did put on certain constraints. You can't change cost sharing. You can't change other factors that Tricia talked about. But I think, honestly, it's a little bit premature to speculate or to assess, given that the commission hasn't yet been established.
I think an important element of there's legitimate concerns, as you raised, Vicki, about the IPAB. I think, one of the areas of great interest is going to be the regulations that are issued that govern the work of the IPAB. And I don't I haven't found anything or anyone that points to how those regs will be developed, but I would imagine they'll be developed by the IPAB itself, given since it is independent. But there are a lot of terms in the statute about, you know, areas that are off limits, and these are all going to need to be defined. One example, you know, the hospitals. Hospital rates aren't affected until 2020. Well, what does that mean? No reduction in coverage. What does that mean? And these will have to be defined in regs, and that's going to be an important area.
And we have a related question regarding the IPAB, and that's what are the implications for MedPAC of the IPAB, and how will the two interact?
MedPAC lives. The legislation's clear about that. MedPAC will continue. One of the roles that MedPAC would play would be to advise Congress, because Congress has a very short period of time in which to receive, evaluate, and maybe modify the recommendations of the Independent Payment Advisory Board. So MedPAC will exist. MedPAC will continue to advise Congress, but I believe there's not much more of a sharing or interactive relationship between the two entities.
And I should add, Mark Miller will be on a panel on Monday, and you can come back and ask that question again. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead, Trish.
Hi, Trish Niemoor from the Center for Medicare Advocacy. One of the quality linchpins in this legislation, as well as in a lot of the literature that we've seen in recent years, is reduction in hospitalizations, in unnecessary hospitalizations. For the past more than a year, the Center for Medicare Advocacy has been seeing massive numbers of people all over the country in a lot of different hospitals in what's called observation status, which is not an inpatient status. And it has a variety of implications for the individual. It has implications about getting into a nursing home on Medicare. It has implications about who pays for what drugs and is the pharmacy in your Part D plan. But for the quality discussion, it has implications about what is an unnecessary rehospitalization. Because, as best we understand, if you're in observation status, that would not count as a rehospitalization under the way the quality measures are. So it seems a matter of some concern if we're indeed seeing that as a way to say you will be paid or not paid more or less for delivering good quality. And I'm wondering, I know that you know about this issue, John, and how you're thinking about that.
That's a great question, and we have seen the same trends in data that I think you're seeing through your interactions with Medicare beneficiaries, but there has been a tremendous increase in the number of observation days. We've started to look into the reasons why that is, and I think some of our thinking about this is having to do the fact with that when a beneficiary comes to the hospital, they may not have the necessary support back at home doesn't quite merit a inpatient stay, but the physician's worried about the beneficiary. The beneficiary doesn't have, you know, could be living alone, could be living in, you know, community, doesn't have the support that could be necessary to prevent the inpatient stay. And so physicians, you know, do the right thing and put the patient into observation stay. So I think we need to look at, you know, more of the societal things going on within the healthcare delivery system and also social supports to kind of best understand the trends behind this. But at the same time, I mean, I think we also need to make sure that we're not creating unintended consequences as we move to bundled payments, as we move to payment reductions to hospitals for certain things. So we're going to be all ears to all these implications. We're going to be, taking comments very seriously. I think this is an area that we need to learn more about. We need input from beneficiary perspective and also the provider perspective. But we're seeing the same trends that you are. We're not exactly sure the reasons why, but we think one of the reasons is the fact that lots of beneficiaries don't necessarily have the social support that they need to not go into the inpatient stay.
Well, we know we're interested in having an ongoing conversation
with you.
Thank you.
Building on what John said and addressing specifically the concern about the readmissions provision, I think that maybe that concern is mitigated by the fact that in Medicare, when a patient is in observation status for the second midnight census when the hospital does its counting, they're automatically converted for Medicare purposes to inpatient status. So that would not be a way around the readmission rule.
Good point. Yes, go right ahead.
My question is for Jonathan. My name is Gail McInnes, and I am with the National Coalition on Care Coordination. You said quite a bit about CMS's interest in getting feedback from stakeholders, and I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about existing opportunities for that input, particularly related to the Office for Duals and the Center for Innovation.
That's a great question. And I know there's a lot of interest about how we're going to be thinking about creating these two offices and who are going to be the particular individuals to lead them, and the processes that CMS will use to take in ideas. We understand the tremendous desire for engagement. Give us a little bit more time. We are still going through those processes. But I expect when we do, you know, start to announce staff, the offices, that our goal is to make sure there is lots of engagement. And so one of the things that we hear loud and clear with the Center for Innovation, for example, is that, you know, folks really want to be working with CMS in a way that can help the agency and help other community programs that are going on to improve the delivery of care. Same is true with dual-eligible coordination. I think we hear very loud and clear that there's so much opportunity to improve the delivery of care for dual-eligible beneficiaries. Give us a little bit more time, a little more patience, but we'll have more to say very soon. But I fully expect that CMS will be acting, and I know the Secretary has been quite direct in this direction, to really engage states, stakeholders, communities, to make sure that we are taking in all that energy.
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. I want to pick up on the question that Joanne Lynn started us with, which is that the Medicare program is administered by the federal government, not by the states at all. And so the incentives that are created to improve quality are incentives for the providers. What can CMS do that will create incentives for the states to use their regulatory authority to build healthcare delivery systems that are more efficient, effective, and equitable? It seems like that avenue is not logically linked to the way Medicare is structured. And it seems that if Medicare is really interested in systemic change that could make a difference in delivery, they have to incentivize the local delivery system and the state, which has no role at all in the administration of the Medicare program. How are you envisaging that happening?
Well, there's a couple ways. I think it's a great question. And, I think folks that work on Medicare are always accused of being the kind of biggest bully in the room. And we have payment systems, and we can change payment systems, and we can affect change. And I think there's some value to that. I mean, I think as the Medicare program goes, oftentimes do states and oftentimes do private payers. So I think, you know, that's a tool at our disposal, you know, to use the largest, you know, payer as the engine for change. But at the same time, we need to make sure that we're also thinking about how Medicare can work with states, can work with private payers to make sure we're all kind of pointing everything in the same direction. So we're not pointing one way and the state of X is not pointing in an opposite way. I've spent a lot of time working with my colleague Cindy Mann, who oversees CMS on the Medicaid and the state side. And I know that she and her staff are very interested in working with Medicare you know, to help promote these changes at the state level. There's tremendous state interest, too. I mean, they're all coming to us and wanting to learn about DRG payments and APCs and to kind of incorporate some of these payment principles that have been in existence on the Medicare side for quite some time. And I think part of the goal with these new centers for dual-eligible innovation is to provide some more flexibility for Medicare, Medicaid, and other payers to work in common ways. The last thing I'll say is that we have announced and will soon hopefully put out to the public space a demonstration proposal for the Medicare program to work with states to promote and coordinate all-payer medical homes to ensure that we're building accountable primary care systems at the local level and kind of use the Medicare program to kind of build off and kind of leverage state projects that are in existence to add some more, you know, kind of muscle or add some more, you know, purchasing power behind those initiatives. I think we've got to balance the tension between sometimes the Medicare program just has to lead, and sometimes we have to work in collaboration, and I think we're going to be looking at both ways to achieve the goal that you're articulating.
Tricia?
The only thing I would add is sometimes we can also learn more from some of the changes that are already taking place. And I'm thinking at this point of the managed care program and special needs plans, some of which integrate care for Medicare and Medicaid dual eligibles. And I think there is a lot we don't know about how those systems are working for people, how it's changing, how care is delivered, and what it means for people. And we can, I think it would help us all to learn more from what's out there in terms of lessons learned and maybe learning from that as we or before we move forward.
But we do have a question about the Center for Innovation, noting that CMS has had a long history of demonstration projects with little impact in many ways on how payments were made. How do you think the Center for Innovation will improve on this? What's different about this effort than previous demonstrations?
Well, I think I want to respectfully disagree with the notion that CMS's demonstration hasn't led to payment policy change. I think two recent examples is that CMS has, conducted a demonstration to pay group practices and a shared savings model. That demonstration has now became the basis for national policy for the accountable care organizations. CMS has conducted demonstrations to work with hospitals to pay bonus payments for those that elevate their performance. Some of those ideas now are national policy. So I don't think it's true that CMS's demonstration work has not led to policy change. I think that the Affordable Care Act has taken some of the recent work and has built permanent payment policy based upon some recent demos. What I do think is true is that the agency doesn't always have the freedom to stop demonstrations when they're not working or to adjust demonstrations when certain things, you know, change or certain dynamics happen. And I think I hear as much criticism that we don't terminate demonstrations when they don't seem to be proving good results. So I think part of the goal with the Center for Innovation is that kind of rapid learning dynamic that we will start projects that have promise, but if they don't work, we'll shift or we will, stop them. But I think there has been tremendous work that has been now built into permanent payment policy. I think the other thing that I hear a lot is just that it takes a long time. It takes 4 to 5 years. You have to do an evaluation. I think that's some of the frustration that exists, just the timelines. And I think the hope that folks have for the Center of Innovation is that we can have faster learning, faster innovation, and that's what we're working very hard to develop that process.
There's some questions here about the SGR fix, and with physicians facing reimbursement cuts every 30 days and the IPAP taking effect in 2015, please discuss any concerns you might have that physicians will stop taking Medicare patients and what you can do to prevent that, and also a follow-up of how would a multi-year doctor fix impact the MA plans as they are brought closer to the 100% of fee-for-service?
Well, I think as somebody who's had to, is this a question for me or somebody?
All right. You can take it, John.
As somebody in the last couple of months that had to manage this process, I think that I can speak well that it is very frustrating for CMS to have to prepare our contractors to implement the law. And then at the last minute, we have to hold claims for 15 days. Again, it is a very awful situation for us to for physicians, and it is not one that we relish by any means. We fully support and fully hope, and the President has been on record of supporting a long-term fix to Medicare physician payments. I think not only does it have tremendous impact on physicians and giving them predictability in reimbursement, but it also feeds into our other payment systems, feeds into beneficiary premiums, it feeds into how we set payment levels for the MA plans. And so it has systematic kind of impacts throughout the Medicare program. And so I think to the administration and the President and Secretary Sebelius, we are working with the Congress to ensure that we can have a multi-year fix to address these concerns.
Okay. The next question relates to how CMS will determine preventive services recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. What's the process that you plan on that?
Well, I think it's a little bit premature. CMS will go through proposed rulemaking. I talked about that we will use the physician fee schedule rule as the vehicle for this proposal. Typically, the physician proposal is published on the end of June. I think that's a good timetable to see our proposal, but I think at this point it's premature to talk until that proposed regulation is public.
And John, another one for you. Can you describe the process for reevaluating the STAR rating system for the MA plans?
Not in detail at this point. Our staff right now are working hard and are developing options, and so I hope, not I hope, that I know we will have more to say later this summer. Going back to the earlier point is that we understand that the STAR system was used primarily as a consumer, was built primarily as a tool to help consumers. We don't have a lot of evidence that consumers use the information to actually choose a plan. I think some of the research that I have heard is that beneficiaries primarily choose a plan based upon their premium, based upon the access to their physician. But I think our hope is that the STAR system becomes a very valuable tool for consumers, and I think that will take some more time. But I think at the same time, given that we're using the STAR system for payment purposes for the first time, which to me is the largest pay-for-performance system that we'll have in the Medicare program, that puts the burden on CMS to take a fresh look, to assess how we determine what's a 4-star plan, what's a 5-star plan. That's a process that we're going on right now. We'll have more to say later this summer. But that's the best I can say right now.
Okay. This is a request to please explain again how the Part B premium will be determined, what will be the base premium.
Well, the base premium is basically 25% of program costs. And this year, for people who are not what's called held harmless, so the Part B premium is about $110. On the income-related premium that applies to people with incomes over $85,000 for individuals, $170,000 for couples, there's a sliding scale so that the higher your income is, the more you pay as a share of the Medicare premium. I think the highest anybody pays this year is $350 a month, depending upon their income. What the new law will do is keep that basic structure, but every year more people will pay the income-related premium if you assume that incomes rise over time. So it just keeps the income thresholds where they are this year, and most likely more people will be subject to that income-related premium. And as Part B premiums rise, they will pay whatever their share of the higher premium is.
Okay. David Rabin, Georgetown. It's well understood that provision of care through primary care is critical to system cost containment. Medicare pays for postgraduate training. The issue of reimbursement and its reallocation of the monies that are provided to physicians to encourage the provision of primary care services, particularly to elderly individuals under Medicare who require more time, effort, counseling, and assistance than the average patient. So I would appreciate your talking about how Medicare is moving or could move under the legislation to strengthening the more cost-containing element of health care provision by physicians' primary care.
I'm not sure I completely understood the question. I mean, Medicare, I think one of the concerns was that, you know, that the medical education payments in Medicare for may not encourage primary care. Medical education payments for Medicare are just for, you know, for the period of initial board eligibility. So, fellowships and additional training after initial board eligibility would not be eligible for Medicare medical education payments. In terms of what the legislation is going to do, I think that the payment changes emphasizing primary care and preventive services are going to probably be the best thing to point to. But John or someone else may have something else to add to that.
I mean, the law provides a lot of support and training for graduate medical education, and I think a very new emphasis on promoting more individuals to go into primary care professions. And I think the Congress recognized that we're going to expand coverage and promote the Medicare program to be more focused on primary care, more accountable care. We need to build that workforce. Kind of following Tom's points, I think we have primary care GME slots that are available in our country today that are not being filled. And so I think we really have to focus on reimbursement and focus on trying to provide the incentives to promote more primary care. We have made changes in our last year's physician fee schedule to change the balance of payments more towards primary care and family medicine. The Affordable Care Act takes further steps. I think also the focus on medical homes and accountable primary care hopefully will encourage more individuals to go into these professions. But I don't necessarily agree that it's just a graduate medical education focus. We have to look at, the incentives that are created to encourage more individuals to go into primary care profession.
I think the one thing to add about the new legislation is it does allow for and require even reallocation of unused medical education slots. So to the extent there are unused primary care slots, then they could get reallocated where they would be used.
Let me ask, we have time for just a question or so more. If you would use that time while you're listening to the exchange to fill out that blue evaluation form, we'd very much appreciate it. Diane?
John, another question for you. How does CMS view the implementation of code creep adjustments in conjunction with health reform market basket reductions that yield negative updates for hospitals?
Let's focus on hospitals. I know that we have that proposal out that has garnered some interest in the hospital community. CMS believes that for all of our payment systems that we need to focus on accurate payments. And so we have lots of mechanisms that are either required by statute that are at the Secretary's discretion to adjust payment levels for changes in coding. And no one, to my knowledge, has said that coding intensity changes is due to fraud or due to kind of inappropriate behavior. But whenever we change a payment system, for example, changing the DRGs, that creates natural incentives to code differently by providers. The agency has said in the past and will continue to stay in the future when we make these changes, we will look at documentation and coding changes to ensure that taxpayers don't pay and beneficiaries don't pay for changes in coding practices. We do it on the MA side, we do it on the home health side, and we are required by law to do for the inpatient hospital side. The law is quite clear that CMS has to capture back the coding and intensity changes that have occurred when CMS went to the new DRG system, I think back in 2007. Each year that we delay, and last year CMS made a proposal, but we ultimately didn't finalize it. Each year that we delay, the amount of funds we have to capture back gets larger and larger, and that's something that CMS is required to do by law. Some have questioned our calculations to measure documentation and coding in the hospital side. CMS's estimates track very closely, almost precisely, to MedPAC's, and I'm very confident in our analytics. But we have tried to take proposals to kind of take these changes over time so they don't have too much impact in any one year. We have an obligation for the inpatient payment system under law. We have put out a proposal that we think balances the tension between complying with the law and not causing undue impact in any one year to the hospitals. But I'm very confident of CMS's analytics, but I think it is a legitimate debate to be had, is what's the best way and the best time period to capture back the documentation and coding changes.
And John, you've done a great job, but one question final is, how limited is CMS in making changes while awaiting the confirmation of a permanent director? Do you want Congress to act quickly?
We have a wonderful secretary who's very much involved and very much into both the strategy of CMS and also the details of CMS. We have a deputy secretary, Bill Kaur, who's very much involved. We have a OMB. We have a White House that has had deep expertise in Medicare policy. While we eagerly await the confirmation of Dr. Don Berwick, I am very confident that we have the policy apparatus from the secretary and her senior team in the White House, and decisions have been made, decisions will continue to be made, but at the same time, we are excited about Don Berwick's confirmation, our nomination.
I suppose you'd probably like this group to move the process a little faster. Yeah.
That's right. Those of you on the Finance Committee staff ought to consider that a question to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for filling out the blue evaluation form. Thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation for helping us think through not just this briefing, but the series of briefings that included numbers on Medicaid and private insurance. Thanks to Diane and Tricia for huge contributions to the success of this one. I repeat, thanks to you for choosing to listen to be educated rather than to get some fresh air, and ask you to join me in thanking our panel for an incredibly useful discussion.